Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. A man who has been making an outsized contribution to our understanding about the single most serious threat facing our country these days, against which we must make a redoubled effort to protect her, is our first guest. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He has been an academic for decades. He is a prolific author, including an important book about Han supremacism, which I commend to you all, as well as a torrent of extremely provocative but thoughtful pieces in various publications, including The Hill. We're always delighted to catch up with him. He is a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, for which I am very grateful, and we look forward to these conversations with him with great enthusiasm. Dr. Bradley Thayer, welcome back to Securing America.
Thank you, Frank. My pleasure.
I want to start by asking you about Shanghai. Brad, we've been told that some 25 million people in China's largest city are being subjected now to, I guess, a second week or more of brutally repressive lockdown in connection with this sort of zero tolerance approach to the COVID-19 pandemic by the Chinese Communist Party. What is up with that and the policy that is underlying it?
Well, Frank, that's an extremely important point that demonstrates the nature of the Chinese regime. So what we're witnessing in Shanghai, of course, is the totalitarian nature of the Chinese Communist Party laid bare in pursuit of this absurd COVID zero policy that they're determined to pursue. Of course, which is ridiculous because COVID, of course, is not going anywhere. It will always be with us. But the party is determined to crack down to ensure that the virus does not spread again. But that is essentially only the public explanation. What is really the intent is to ensure the party's control over all elements of the local government of Shanghai, which there is concern with Xi that might have independent tendencies. So this crackdown in Shanghai should be seen at several levels. The epidemiological aspect of it, of course, is the public face. And the brutality that's evinced there is telling enough. But it's really an aspect of control, and that also informs what we have seen with Hong Kong, where the party has cracked down on Hong Kong for political purposes, not necessarily in this instance for COVID. What we witness with Wuhan, where the party, of course, where the virus started famously, and the naked aggression of the party against its own people was evinced. So we should see what's happening in Shanghai as a human rights disaster for the Chinese people. And it's simply one of many made possible by the COVID epidemic. But when we put it in the long history of the Chinese Communist Party, we really see its true nature.
Now, this is such an important point, Brad. And you mentioned Xi Jinping, of course, the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. This factionalism, as I guess it's called, this possibility that there is a Shanghai gang that is threatening his hold on power, his expected ascendancy to a third term when the People's Congress meets in the fall, as an underlying factor in what they're doing here, and the kinds of techniques that they're able to bring to bear. It's not just sealing people into their apartment buildings, which they're doing, or otherwise denying them freedom of movement. It's also, isn't it, the sort of use of these coercive techniques like the social credit system, as they call it, to monitor what people are doing and how they're doing it, that intensifies the level of repression, does it not?
It does indeed, Frank. In essence, information technology makes totalitarianism cheap and very efficient. What Stalin could not accomplish, despite his best efforts, in advanced technology that we're witnessing around the world, of course, but in China, reveals that control of individuals, groups of individuals, but specific individuals, is it's done easily. And so what we're witnessing with individual QR, essentially identification documents with the COVID passes, et cetera. Again, the epidemic is being used as an excuse to accelerate already the heavy hand of the Chinese Communist Party.
Brad, can you give us a sense of the toll that it's taking in Shanghai specifically, and the cost more broadly of, as you say, this practice being applied really throughout the country, both the lockdowns and the social credit system monitoring? And if I could just ask you as well about Shanghai being a major port for China's exporting of goods worldwide. What is it doing to supply chains, all of this locking down?
Very important issues, Frank, of course. This has clearly disrupted the city. Shanghai, of course, is the one of China's major port, of course. And so this disruption is having the knock-on effects on, again, global transportation networks around the world. Obviously, that's going to be contributing to further delays in the United States and contributing to the supply chain crisis that we face here, with additional effects on inflation and additional effects, of course, on our economy. So what's happening in Shanghai, of course, is extremely important, not simply because of the human rights abuses, although that should be identified explicitly, not because of simply because of the pattern that this demonstrates with respect to the behavior of the Chinese Communist Party and their abuse of their own citizens. But thirdly, it demonstrates the willingness of the Chinese Communist Party to drive and to disrupt the global economy. For Xi, control is absolute, even if it comes at the cost of disrupting China's economic relations with the rest of the world. At the same time, of course, the political relationship is disrupted as a result of Ukraine, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and of course, the actions that we're witnessing in Europe as well as around the world. So the supply chain effect is very significant. And we should expect that this demonstrates, Frank, as we know too well, that China is an unreliable partner. And we should, again, do our utmost to separate ourselves from any type of dependence on the Chinese economy.
Really, it is the height of recklessness to be dependent upon these guys for anything, let alone for as much as we are. And we'll be talking more about this in the latter part of this program with Bill Walton. But, you know, I've had a chance, Brad, to take a look at something that is very, very ominous. And it may be the wellspring of this disease and its affliction on the Chinese people, as well as obviously the rest of the world. And that is China's interest in biological warfare. There's a speech that was made apparently to an elite group of party cadre by the then Secretary of Defense, Minister of Defense of China, Qi Haoqian, back in about 20 years ago. And what he laid out was a program of, well, using biological warfare against us. We're going to talk more about that with Brad Thayer on the other side of a very short break. We're going to visit about its implications, obviously, for the American people, but also, again, for our relationship with the Chinese Communist Party in the meantime. That and more right after this. Thank you. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It's often said that elections have consequences. Rarely, though, has an election in one country had more profound consequences for another than the change from Donald Trump to Joe Biden has had on Israel. Before President Trump left office, the Jewish state had benefited greatly from his commitment to its sovereignty, security, and right to defend itself against Iran and allied terrorists. And Mr. Trump denied the Palestinians a veto over improved relations between Israelis and Arabs willing to make peace. Team Biden, by contrast, has repeatedly undermined Israel and those who share its determination to counter the threat they all face from an incipient nuclear-armed Iran. He has, moreover, emboldened the mullahs with promises of perhaps another $150 billion, and he's renewed the Palestinians' conviction that they can wage jihad against the Jews with impunity. This won't end well. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to say we're continuing a tremendously important conversation with Dr. Bradley Thayer, member of our Committee on the Present Danger China, and one of the great experts in this country on the Chinese Communist Party and its ambitions. And Brad, I wanted to ask you about this speech by the then Minister of Defense, Chi Hao-chen. Do you credit the idea that the Chinese Communist Party would actually envision using biological weapons, as he indicated was the case, for the purposes of depopulating the United States and colonizing it, and that anything that is made to look as though they're really preoccupied with Taiwan is really just a feint for that larger purpose against what they consider to be their main enemy, namely us?
Well, this is a very important issue, Frank, as you mentioned. 3 points with respect to this. First, we need to recognize that that China is the enemy of the United States. And so when we have speeches, and this speech is not alone, and we should recognize, of course, that there is a pattern of expression along these lines directed at the United States. China recognizes us as their enemy, and we should do the same. So the remarks of the Chinese defense minister are fully in keeping with their broader strategy of unrestricted warfare. Frank, I know you know this very well, and you've covered it many times, but its importance cannot be underestimated. The Chinese approach to the United States is to attack us in an azimuths manner. That is, legally, in ideological warfare, in economic warfare, in kinetic warfare in time, but to use every weapon at their disposal, including biological weapons, to undermine the United States, the homeland of the United States, as well as, of course, our allies in international politics. So because they see us as their enemy, we should greatly appreciate in a way that we have not thus far, certainly, that they will employ every mechanism to undermine, to attack the American people. We should also consider, Frank, that fentanyl, and that is the drugs, the opiate crisis, has a Chinese origin. And the Chinese are doing their utmost to accelerate that. So we see, and with an open border, of course, that we're very likely to have very soon, we'll see the expansion of drugs, of course, of opiates, other dangerous narcotics come across the southern border. This should be seen
a form of chemical warfare, if you will. Yeah, 100,000 Americans being lost, I think, last year to it. And it's you're absolutely right to point that out as well. And just let me say, I think you meant to say overestimate the importance of all of this. It is really vital that we understand this is not something we're making up. This is not something that we're conjuring. This is something that they've made abundantly clear is their policy, and they are far advanced in exercising it. And the biological attack, I personally believe that COVID-19 represents may have been a dress rehearsal for something far worse. Brad, let me talk about something else that you've recently written about, because it's both important in its own right, and it sets up very nicely the conversation I'm going to have in our next segment with former Major Fred Galvin. When you look at what is critical to our national security in the face of the sorts of threats you've just talked about, it clearly comes down to the readiness, the professionalism, the esprit de corps, the quality, the deterrent value, in short, of the United States military. Talk a little bit about one of the things that you think is critical to all of that and how it compares to the Chinese People's Liberation Army.
Well, certainly, Frank. Again, this is a critical issue. It does not receive the attention it deserves. And this is to ensure that the United States sustains the right type of civil-military relations in this country that we've had now for generations. And that is that the civilian leadership, Frank, you know this well from your time in the Pentagon, the civilian leadership provides oversight and it provides direction, but it leaves the military domain to the military, which is a fundamental component of what's called objective civilian control. In countries that we see around the world, like China, they have politicized militaries, and that is where the military is a tool of the Communist Party of China, for example, or of the Soviet military was, of course, of the Soviet Union. And they are not professional militaries. And that affects their behavior in their ability to, in their military effectiveness. So one of our great strengths has been our tradition of a professional military in the operating under the principles of objective civilian control. Elements that erode that are when the military becomes politicized, when the civilians reach into the military domain and start requiring changes in how the military structures itself, how it trains itself, etc. So we have seen, of course...
Well, it's culture, among other things, and the indoctrination that's being applied to them on critical race theory, for example, is a rampant example of that.
The importance of its history, appreciating its history, its traditions, and its culture, as you said, all are extremely important in ensuring that that military domain is the best that it can be. That, and again, that is our great strength. And as we chip away at this, as we chip away at the foundation with the teachings, as you said, of the of critical race theory, of other elements to
social experimentation, the transgender agenda, and on and on. Yeah, it is politicizing it. And Brad, just to put a fine point on it, the Chinese Communist Party, like the Soviet Union, has political commissars integrated into its military units. And I think it's always a question as to who has more power in the command chain within those units. Is it the nominal military brass, or is it actually the political cadre that are there monitoring everybody and making sure that everybody conforms? Talk a little bit about the implications for the Chinese People's Liberation Army of having that kind of structure, and the danger that we may be replicating it in ours to some extent with the kinds of practices we've just discussed.
Indeed, it is a politicized force, and that weakens its combat effectiveness, the military effectiveness of the People's Liberation Army and the other elements of the Chinese military are hindered by that structure. And the corruption that that entails, where junior officers have to pay bribes, if you will, to senior officers in order to simply maintain their positions or to be considered for promotion or many other elements. This greatly hinders the professionalization of the People's Liberation Army. And from our perspective, of course, that's a positive element, but we should be aware that that's a cancer, that once that is introduced, it will metastasize. And there will always be another demand or another effort to continue a political expansion of civilian interference, in essence, in the military domain, which weakens military effectiveness. So we have witnessed this, and again, the Chinese have this system, and it is to their great detriment, which keeps it from being a truly professional military force, and that would greatly adverse their combat effectiveness.
Yeah. Well, this is good news for us. The bad news is if we replicate it here, we're going to find perhaps the advantage we might otherwise enjoy with a self-criticizing and healing military being made diminished. That's right, an honest military. Brad, we are out of time. We have to leave it at that for the moment, but we will have you back soon to talk about this further. And thank you for your help in teeing up, as I say, the conversation with Major Galvin, which we will have momentarily, about what was done to his unit of special operators in Afghanistan and beyond. That and more straight ahead.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He's a friend of this program. We've had him on a number of times talking about one of the great, well, travesties, it seems to me, of military injustice involving a unit that came to be called MARSOC 7 that he commanded at the time it was deployed in Afghanistan and subjected to, well, an IED-led ambush and an awful lot of misconduct by superior officers in its wake. His name is Major Fred Galvin, United States Marine Corps retired, and he has been a champion for both his own men who suffered at the hands of first the Afghans and then the Marines and others in the United States military chain of command, as well as for other MARSOC individuals who have also been subjected to some, outrages, I think it's fair to say. We're going to talk about all of that with him now. Major Galvin, welcome back to Securing America. It's terrific to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much, sir.
I'm excited beyond words about your forthcoming book that is going to talk a lot about what happened in all of this, especially with the MARSOC 7 group. It's called, and I think this is just an absolutely fabulous title, A Few Bad Men, The True Story of U.S. Marines Ambushed in Afghanistan and Betrayed in America. Give us a quick synopsis of it. I don't want to steal your thunder for when the book comes out, and we'll have you back to talk about it then. But just a reminder of what your troops were put through at the time and thereafter.
Yes, Frank. The as you had just mentioned, we were on a patrol entering this village right on the Afghan-Pakistan border. A morning in 2007, March 4th, and explosive device in inside a van filled with fuel, detonated in the front of our patrol, and that initiated a complex ambush where we were then engaged by four suicide jihadists that were in another vehicle, aiming right at the front of our patrol again, trying to finish us off. Our Marines aimed in very specifically on that dirt road, nobody else around, and killed those jihadists in that vehicle. The next engagement was on our opposite flank on the right side, in a dry riverbed. Again, no civilians there, but they were bounding in formation in this dry riverbed, quickly oriented. Marines aimed in and killed them. And this was not the fog of war in the middle of the night. This happened at 9:03 in the morning is when it was initiated. It was over in less than a few minutes. They did try to continue to advance. They pulled a vehicle across the road, swarmed at us while sniper fire was being rained in on us from a mountaintop. We remained in that ambush zone for 5 minutes until we made sure that the front of our patrol, which had been blown up, was okay when it was able to maneuver in their vehicle. And then we departed the area, fired above the heads of this mob of men. There was zero women and children at that time. But when we returned to the base 20 minutes later, it had already been out on the BBC in 20 minutes, Frank, from the attack. It was out that we had killed 19 Afghan women, children, and elderly, and wounded 50 other Afghans. So this was a clear case, not just of information warfare at the hands of the Taliban, but what it came later to become is a rush to judgment and information warfare perpetuated by our own military leaders, saying that we had mass murdered women and children.
So it was an op by the Taliban and their supporters in the media. And then you were essentially, as you say, betrayed by your commanding officers who failed to take your word for it or even fully investigate the facts before finding you guilty as charged by this Taliban-led information warfare operation. So catch us up quickly on what has happened in the years since this went down, Major, and I want to salute you personally for your leadership throughout in trying to make sure that there was justice rendered after your team were defamed and subjected to, it seems, really a most misbegotten and long-running, not just prosecution, but persecution.
Yes. Well, Frank, this unfortunate case, I mean, we were labeled as mass murderers. We were stated as such by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who stated publicly to the press that the commandant of the Marine Corps was very disappointed in the conduct of these Marines. Congressman Adam Smith from Washington also condemned us publicly in front of the press. Other members of our chain of command did the same thing, so we felt very hopeless. However, we did go into a court. It was the longest trial in Marine Corps history. We were exonerated at the end of it, but it took 4 months, and they did not use legal terms such as innocent or not guilty or dismissed. After 4 months on a Friday night, they said we acted appropriately. So when you ask about this, this was a campaign, intentional campaign, on behalf of our military leaders to have us basically take the fall and keep that stink on us. And then it took 15 years using those same, I had to coordinate with the media after I retired because I had a gag order while in the military. I coordinated with members of Congress, such as the late Congressman Jones. And we also had bicameral and bipartisan support. And the people, the United States, took action, signed petitions, and led to a act of Congress, House Resolution 21 in the 115th Congress, to finally get to the point where we're at now and clear our names, which did occur in 2019, the day after former Secretary of Mattis was fired. We had a Department of the Navy released a 12-page, very clear exoneration of the MARSOC 7.
Wonderful. Well, again, it wouldn't have happened, but for the concerted efforts that you and others made on your behalf, and I salute you for doing it. We were talking in the previous segment with Brad Thayer, Major Galvin, about the professionalism of the Marines and other members of our military, the importance of being self-critical to understand, you know, what mistakes are made and to correct them. That's a critical piece of our war fighting, I think, capability and the professionalism of the force. And unfortunately, there are a couple of other MARSOC individuals, and that's Marine Special Operations Forces, who have been similarly, it seems, singled out for mistreatment by the various command elements and the military justice system. Talk a little bit about where things stand now with the so-called MARSOC 3.
Yes, Frank, this is an atrocity as well. And it's stemmed from a case, New Year's 2019, this was 40 months ago, where two Marine Raiders and a Navy corpsman that's also attached to the Marine Special Operations Command encountered a retired Army Green Beret. And the Army Green Beret continued to escalate his comments and actions. It led to the retired Green Beret, a 275-pound, very massive bodybuilder, came in and struck one of the Marine gunnies twice in the face, coming in a third time before one of the other Marine gunnery sergeants came in to defend him, hit him in the assaulter in the face once, knocking him down. He injured his head, had a gash on the back of his head, and unfortunately, nearly 5 or 4 days later, he died from complications of choking on his vomit. But all three of these men are currently being charged with homicide. The mainstream media does not want to pick up on this, Frank, and it's regrettable because the one Marine who was being assaulted, an African-American Marine, doesn't fit the mold because he's serving his nation. And, you know, his crime, of which he is currently being charged with homicide for Gunnery Sergeant Dreyer, is that he was assaulted twice. He was trying to de-escalate. His hands were down. There was no other punches, no weapons. And, you know, here he's facing a general court-martial.
Now, I understand that there have been two actions taken, one in February by a military judge who dismissed charges against one of these individuals, the corpsman, as I understand it, and a retired Army officer, I think an enlisted man by the name of Brian Mast, a double amputee for his service in Iraq, now a member of Congress from Florida, has written on behalf of these remaining individuals and their charges against them. Where do things stand right this minute, and what can be done to try to help?
Yes. So this judge is not a Marine judge. It was taken in. So the Navy judge who presided in the corpsman's chief, Eric Gilmet, who was, he was the one treating the assaulter after he was injured. That judge threw the case out, dismissed it with prejudice. And the government has mentioned that they would like to file an appeal to continue this case. This has been going on for 40 months, just over 3 years. And the stakes are very high because the max punishment for homicide is just like that kook Major Hassan Nadal, who was a mass murderer. The max punishment's death, and very serious charges. So we're hoping, just like the actions of a congressman, because the people implored Congressman Mast, that there's more congressmen and women that fight for these MARSOC 3.
We have to leave it at that. Major Fred Galvin, thank you. Come back to us with updates on all of this. And again, congratulations on the new forthcoming book. You can order it today, A Few Bad Men. We'll look forward to your next report. Thank you, sir. God bless you. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton about changes headed your way in the China battle space right after this. This is Frank Afting with the Secure Freedom Minute. It's often said that elections have consequences. Rarely, though, has an election in one country had more profound consequences for another than the change from Donald Trump to Joe Biden has had on Israel. Before President Trump left office, the Jewish state had benefited greatly from his commitment to its sovereignty, security, and right to defend itself against Iran and allied terrorists. And Mr. Trump denied the Palestinians a veto over improved relations between Israelis and Arabs willing to make peace. Team Biden, by contrast, has repeatedly undermined Israel and those who share its determination to counter the threat they all face from an incipient nuclear-armed Iran. He has, moreover, emboldened the mullahs with promises of perhaps another $150 billion, and he's renewed the Palestinians' conviction that they can wage jihad against the Jews with impunity. This won't end well. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back, and it is time for our weekly visit with our friend Bill Walton. He is one of the people that we turn to each week for analysis and insights into, well, parts of the battle space, as I think of it, that he's particularly conversant in, namely finance and economic affairs more generally. Bill is a recovering master of the universe on Wall Street. These days he has a number of ventures, but the most important of them, I think, is his terrific online television podcast. It is called The Bill Walton Show, and we are always privileged to have him with us. Bill, welcome back to Securing America.
Frank, great to be here.
Much to talk about. I'm particularly interested, as usual, in your thoughts about China, Bill, and what it is up to in this financial battle space. I was very impressed by a billionaire by the name of Peter Thiel, who knows his way around the ins and outs of economic warfare, high technology, finance, and the like, who went after what he calls the financial gerontocracy and its engagement with China. Talk a bit about what Peter Thiel is saying and why it is important.
Well, there's an old saying on Wall Street, it's called talking your book. And what that basically means, when you get a money manager out talking about how the economy is going to go one way or the other, they're essentially not too subtly talking about what you ought to buy or sell based on what they own or what they're short. And in the case of Peter Thiel, he was speaking at a Bitcoin conference, a cryptocurrency conference recently, and he called out Warren Buffett, Jamie Dimon, and Larry Fink as you point out, the gerontocracy. Well, all these men have their financial models based in the old economy. And they have a lot at stake and a lot to lose if somehow Bitcoin comes on to overtake the U.S. dollar or other asset classes. And, you know, to give some context, the place to be as an investor the last 40 years has been in equities. That's gone, the multinational, large cap multinationals have gone up astronomically in the last 40 years, and it's been almost a safe haven. In 1980, the total market cap of the U.S. or the multinationals was about $2 trillion, and the price of gold, about total value of gold in the economy, was about $2 trillion. Now equities have gone to like $140 trillion, and gold is like at $7 trillion, so equities have vastly outpaced it. But the other asset class that I think they're worried about and they want to kill it in the cradle are Bitcoin cryptocurrencies, which are a little bit less than $1 trillion. Now, let me say, right now, and I'm sure I'm among a lot of people, nobody really understands what's going on with their money right now, both in the United States and worldwide. Inflation, all the tectonic plates are shifting, and Buffett, Dimon, and Fink want to keep them arranged to their benefit.
And to their benefit has, to a considerable degree, certainly in the case of Larry Fink, and I think Jamie Dimon to some extent, presumably Warren Buffett as well, involves investing in China, involves investing in the so-called ESG space, which Peter Thiel suggested that environment, social justice, governance business is really just another prop under the Chinese Communist Party. Get at what he's laying out there, because it seems to me a critical insight.
Peter Thiel is such an interesting thinker, and I think absolutely on point on this, because you look at ESG, environmental social governance, if you have U.S. companies or large multinationals complying with you know, dotting the I and crossing the T on all of that, they basically shut down a lot of their businesses. And who was the net beneficiary of that, particularly on climate change, would be China. Because if we go to wind and solar, as I've pointed out, most of that stuff is manufactured in China, or subcomponents manufactured in China, and certainly a lot of the important rare earth minerals are there. So ESG plays straight into the hands of the Chinese Communist Party agenda. And the question we all are inquiring minds want to know is, why does Larry Fink want to play directly into the hands of the Chinese Communist Party, particularly when the alarms are sounding about as loud as they could sound right now about the nakedness of their ambitions?
Well, nakedness is one way of putting it. The global character and the necessity, as they see it, of achieving that global dominance requires the United States to be removed from the picture. So essentially, as you're saying, Bill, Larry Fink and perhaps these other members of the gerontocracy are actually batting for the other team in a very, very much life and death struggle with the Chinese Communist Party, I fear. Which brings me to our Mad as Hell campaign. Bill, you are a member of our Committee on the Present Danger China, and we've been developing and beginning to roll out elements of a, well, alternative, that people who love this country, people who are patriots, people who want to ensure that their money is actually invested patriotically and in the interest of our country, are, you know, going to not have Larry Fink, Jamie Dimon, Ray Dalio, Steve Schwarzman, or any of these other masters of the universe putting their money in the service of the Chinese Communist Party, our mortal enemy. How important do you think it is that people awaken to the reality that that's what's being done with their money? And, you know, the returns may or may not be all that great for them, but they're very good for the gerontocracy types. That's for sure.
Well, for the established elite companies, the existing regime is working just fine, and they don't want to change. Now, having said that, there are a lot of people waking up to the national defense issues and our security issues and all our interrelationship with China. This is not the old Cold War with the Soviet Union, where we had two very separate economies. Today, we're finding ourselves completely intertwined with China in virtually every single market. And, you know, for example, you and I have talked about with Rosemary Gibson, our essential drugs are basically manufactured or assembled in China.
Hey, that's Bill, hold that thought. The supply chain issue is one of the things I want to come back to. We just have to take a very short break. When we return, we're going to complete this part of the conversation with the great Bill Walton and also get into what is being done by the Chinese with what may or may not be a convertible cryptocurrency, but one that's programmable and potentially very seductive, very dangerous. That and more straight ahead. Welcome back. We are joined once again by Bill Walton. We're talking with him about stuff that matters a lot, not just to financiers and the so-called masters of the universe, but to ordinary folks probably like you, who, whether you know it or not, have your money invested in China because Larry Fink and Ray Dalio and Steve Schwarzman and others have been incessantly putting a portion of their investments that you underwrite into various companies, including, if you can believe it, not only state-owned enterprises of Chinese communism, but also the People's Liberation Army's owned companies. This is madness. And Bill, there has been some talk, and our Committee on the Present Danger, China's chairman, Brian Kennedy, wrote a letter last week to the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission asking whether, in fact, we are looking at a possible change in the behavior of the Chinese. Back in 2013, with Joe Biden's help, then as vice president, as you know, a deal was struck whereby the Chinese not only had access to our capital markets and all of that investor money, but they had it on a preferential basis. They didn't have to conform to our statutory and regulatory arrangements intended to protect investors. There's some talk that they're now going to begin conforming to those laws. We wanted to know what Chairman Gensler thought of all of that and whether it's real. And more generally, where's the MOU? We'd like to know where that memorandum of understanding is. It's no longer available publicly. What do you make of all of this? And is it likely that the Chinese are going to start playing by the rules?
Well, Frank, you know the history. China goes back 3,000 years, and they still are talking about their century of humiliation when the Brits got them hooked on opioids or opium, and they've never forgotten it. And they don't see any law in the world, any international law, any U.S. law, any law you can think of in any other jurisdiction except their own applying to them. And so look at what they did with the World Trade Agreements. They basically signed up and then did exactly what they wanted to do, which is not comply with any of the agreements. What's happening with this SEC now is that you and I have talked about the fact that Chinese companies listed in the United States have not been audited by anything other than Chinese auditing firms, who are notoriously lax at covering and pulling red flags on things that you and I would care about as investors.
No, the Chinese say that those financials are state secrets. They're not about to make those public. Last time I checked.
Exactly. And now the Chinese are beginning to have second thoughts about how tough they want to be on this. And they're saying, well, gee, maybe we'll let somebody else audit our companies in order to let you keep them listed on the U.S. exchanges and the other international exchanges, NASDAQ, New York Stock Exchange. The odds of them not gaining this are zero. Whatever they agree to, there's going to be something behind the scenes that we ought to be very suspicious of. And if we wanted to be doing the right thing, we ought to say, look, China's declared itself an enemy of the United States. We should not let the Chinese companies have access to our capital markets, and putting our American investors' savings at risk.
Amen. Bill, I couldn't have said it better, and you nailed it. Let me ask you about one other piece of this. The Chinese, going back to what you talked about earlier, Bill, have begun rolling out internally, and I think will shortly be doing so internationally. It remains to be seen whether it's a convertible e-yuan, a cryptocurrency issued by the Central Bank of China. What do you think is likely to be the upshot of that? Will it become, as the Chinese clearly hope, the alternative to the dollar, something they've been trying to knock off its pedestal as the reserve currency of the world?
Well, pardon my mixing my metaphors, but the cryptocurrencies are the big gold rush that's going on now. And it's, the libertarians initially thought that cryptocurrencies would be something that could exist outside of control of the various states around the world. Well, the various states of the world don't like that, and they're beginning to create their own cryptocurrencies. And nobody really knows how this is quite going to play out and who or what might be dominant. You know, the benefit of Bitcoin, it has no board of directors, has no ownership, and theoretically is free from coercion and corruption. But we don't know. The jury's still out. The idea that China is going to create a digital currency is a nice idea, but there are 140, now I may exaggerate somewhat, but there are about 100 countries that are thinking about creating a digital currency. And if you think that's a safe haven, look what happened to the truckers in Canada. Yes, they had their bank accounts frozen, but they also had their Bitcoin accounts frozen. And I'm not conversant with all the details, but the place where the people thought they had their safe haven for their capital was not a safe haven.
Yeah. And this is the thing that's so concerning, is if those central banks have their way, and particularly the Chinese one will, they will be able to manipulate those, notes, whatever they are, coins, crypto coins, specifically, Bill, with respect to programming them so that they may not be usable in certain places or only for a certain period of time or only if you play by their rules or only if you're using it in a way they approve of. And these are the sorts of things that I think are clearly a problem with any of these state-controlled enterprises.
Well, Frank, the acronym is DBCG, Central Bank Digital Currencies, and they'd like to eliminate the middleman, which is your local bank, which used to be on the corner, and have you bank directly with, for example, the Federal Reserve. But what that does is it allows them to track where you're spending your money. And think about the Chinese social credit system. They give you points for good behavior.
What could possibly go wrong with all of that? Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is a point to which we will return, as we have done now several times, because I think it is a coming thing. A programmable currency manipulated by a hostile government. Could that include our own? Watch this space. Bill Walton, thank you for the great work you do at The Bill Walton Show. I am privileged to be one of your guests from time to time, and I just commend you for what you do with it and hope everyone will be following it closely. In the meantime, I hope the rest of you will follow us here at Securing America. I hope you found today's program to be edifying and to help you better fight the good fight for our freedoms. Until next time, this is Frank Gaffney. Go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.